Okay. Chris, it's very nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
No, I'm really pleased to be here, Nathan. Yeah, Chris is just fine.
Okay,
yeah.
Perfect. So you are the associate dean, and you're a professor of large animal sciences at the university?
Yeah, at the Western College of Veterinary Medicine at the U of S.
Okay. And have you always wanted to be a vet? Or?
Yeah, I think there's this thing in veterinary medicine, and apparently there's some research on it, that like most people who go into veterinary medicine sort of decide on a career choice before the age of 10.
Oh, really?
Wow. So I think I was one of those. So yeah, all the way through high school.
That's cool.
Well, middle school, high school, that was all I ever wanted to be.
I'm sorry, I didn't offer you water.
Coffee's fine.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, did you grow up around animals or?
Like obliquely. Like we had some pets later in my life, but I probably, if I had to like pick the moment that made it, my grandparents lived in a rural cottage in southern England.
Oh, okay.
And so their immediate neighbor was a dairy farmer.
Yeah.
And so like my earliest memories of childhood are being at my grandparents' house. And when we were there, we would go for walks around the farm. And so he had a horse and he had Jersey dairy cows. And so we used to go and watch the cows being milked.
That's cool.
In the afternoon. So that's probably where the seed came from.
Yeah, you would think so. Hey.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's awesome. And did you like participate on the farm much or just watching growing up? Or?
So those early memories were really just watching.
Yeah.
There was a little bit of time I recall my dad and his brothers helping. He was quite elderly, the farmer, helping him like build haystacks and transport hay around. So I remember being around that. But then in my teenage years, my dad was actually really instrumental in this. He's like, so if you want to be a vet, you've got to learn about animals. So my uncle had a pet food business. So I used to work in the pet food store, which was great about dealing with the public and dealing with animals a little bit that way. And then volunteering for jobs on farms and actually getting that hands-on experience was really, really important for what I do, because I'm a large animal veterinarian. Mm-hmm. So learning about cattle, horses, sheep, pigs, that type of thing.
Yeah, so it seems like it wasn't really ever just a decision. It's just kind of happened to just keep going that way.
Yeah, and as I said, I'm really grateful because I had great opportunities. Some great people sort of said to me, no, if you really want to do this, you need to understand it. So you need this experience, not just to get into vet school, but like, and actually I talk to our students about this all the time, which is, because you start with the desire to be a vet very young, I think you have to often have a very childish view of what being a veterinarian is. And so we face this thing with all our students as they go through the veterinary program, which is at some point that like childish view of veterinary medicine, I joke, it's like the Barbie Dreamhouse vet model of veterinary medicine, is going to collide with reality. And actually helping our students navigate that collision, because everybody's going to hit it at a different point where you understand that the job is very different from your expectations.
Right. You know, that makes perfect sense. I think, especially because when you grow up around, like, I think most people like just grow up with that have animals. It's like typically like a pet, and your understanding of the vet is like getting a medicine here or there and these things and small interactions like that. You don't think about how large scale and how many different capacities a vet has to act in.
And you don't see the stuff beyond that case. So the concept of the veterinarian as a member of a team is really important to understand. And often a team leader as well, in addition to that. And then just the complexity of the decision-making process in terms of getting information from a client and then being able to talk to a client about, I think people often bring up treatment options, but like how to spend their money to make a diagnosis, because it's fee for service, right? So every test is going to cost money and every test is going to potentially give you some information. And so how do you counsel people to spend their money?
Right.
Right. Yeah. And oftentimes money's a limited resource, right? So how do you spend money on diagnosis, recognizing that you need a diagnosis, because then you get to, then you're spending money on treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And so every decision you make as a veterinarian comes with a cost.
Right.
And so you've got to be able to talk to people about money. No one wants to talk about money.
Especially not in that context.
No, exactly. And the other thing that, you know, I try to talk to applicants to vet school, because everybody would say to me, you know, what makes a good veterinarian? And again, because they have this slightly juvenile way of looking at the world, it's like, oh, you've got to love animals and that sort of thing. And I mean, don't get me wrong, like the desire to work with animals is key, but it's not enough. What you actually need is the desire to work with people, right? Because being a veterinarian caring for animals doesn't help, because you're going to be a member of a team. You're going to be in a team working in potentially stressful and difficult circumstances. So you've got to be able to work with people. And then you're going to deal with clients on great days when a family gets a new puppy, right? Best day of their lives.
Yeah.
But you've also got to deal with people on the worst day of their lives, when their dog's been hit by a car, when money's tight, and people are going to be forced to make really difficult decisions. And so if you can't respect people and empathize with people and counsel people, through those and educate to some extent people through those really difficult situations, the love of animals just isn't going to be enough.
Yeah, you can't just lovey-dovey your way through it. Yeah.
No. And in fact, that can lead you into some really difficulties in this profession.
Yeah, I imagine. Wow. Yeah, actually, I've never thought about it from that perspective, especially the cost perspective, because it's not like going to the hospital here where it's covered for you. It is a financial decision. Yeah.
Oh, and that is where I think people struggle, right? You know, it's funny being this close to the States, you know, where obviously healthcare costs are like front and center in people's minds. And so people's sticker shock at discovering what it's going to cost to do surgery on an animal. And I just want to stress, like, the balance changes a little bit, but these things I've talked about exist in companion animal practice with dog and cats and other pets. They exist in equine practice, and then they exist in a different way, but it's still part of the same thing when you're dealing with agricultural practice, which is where I've spent the majority of my career, where not only am I dealing with animals where there is, you know, be completely honest, there is an emotional attachment to farm animals from the majority of farmers, right? They really like their animals. But then it's a business decision as well, just to make things even more complicated.
Yeah. What do you think it is that people maybe I'm wrong, but it seems like a lot of the mainstream people forget that farmers actually care about their animals.
I don't know. The reason I brought it up is because, like, I've spent 25 years of my career working with farmers, right? And farmers are incredible people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're talking about people who basically don't get a day off. It's a 7-day work week. Mm-hmm. It's a 365 days of the year commitment, and it's often long hours, and it's a difficult job. And you can't do that if you don't have, you know, often they won't say they love their animals, but if you don't have real respect for your animals and actually enjoy working with those animals, you just can't sustain that.
Yeah.
But because I think the general population is so far removed from agriculture, I was just reading a statistic this morning, I think less than 2% of the population of Canada are involved in farming now.
Oh, wow.
So few of people have real life experience of what it means to care for an animal in an agricultural context. And they also just don't understand farming. You know, we were talking earlier about this like childhood vision of being a veterinarian. I think most people's understanding of farming is incredibly juvenile. You know, I joke that the average member of the general public, their understanding of true agriculture stops somewhere during elementary school. So they have this vision of old McDonald's farms, the farm is supposed to be. So if you don't have a cow, a pig, a chicken, and a horse, you're not a real farmer. And so they're almost immediately turned off by the fact that there's a dairy farm with just dairy cows, that there's a chicken farm that only has chickens. And they immediately think there's something wrong with that, rather than actually being educated into how this farm is built and what it does and what the farmer does to ensure the welfare that the animals are protected. Yeah. But there's just the natural reaction is that somehow or other it's wrong, without actually asking why do they do that? How do they run this operation? What is the primary function of this?
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. I didn't know that statistic about so many people not being But I guess it makes sense, right? Like it.
Well, remember, that's across Canada statistic. Yeah. Like Saskatchewan is a little different. Like Saskatchewan is a little separated. Like agriculture is closer here. I mean, when I talk to students and people, you know, they may be one or two generations off the farm. The grandparents had a farm, that sort of thing. But you know, when you look at Canada as a whole, that statistic actually kind of makes sense.
Yeah, now that you say that, because it's like most people in the business district of Toronto are not.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, they're going to have no understanding of how you raise pigs.
Yeah,
how you the beef cows are different from dairy cows.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was. Yeah, it's yeah, it's interesting. It's too bad that people don't have a little bit more exposure, because then they get these weird ideas like having just a dairy farm is a bad thing, or having just a chicken farm is a bad thing.
And there, I mean, there are programs out there to try to get people out to farms in both Canada and in other countries to try to do that. And I mean, oftentimes, you know, modern agriculture has been burned in the past, right? Mm-hmm. You know, that you know, you invite people out and then they immediately start to just pick it apart rather than actually engaging in a dialogue and wanting to understand why things are done the way they are. Dealing with the fact that most people are going to anthropomorphize continuously, right? So I wouldn't want to be treated like that, therefore this is wrong, rather than actually trying to understand the science behind it and the research that means this is why we do things this way.
Yeah.
And I'm recognizing the fact it's an ongoing process, right? We've been through decades of research in animal science and we're continuing to improve, and occasionally we try something for the best of intentions and then discover it creates more problems, so we move in and move beyond that. You know, it's not like we're perfect right now. We're never going to be perfect, but we're hopefully always understanding more and continuing to improve.
Yeah, just getting better, and that's the best you can hope for, right? Not every step can be right in the perfect direction.
No, it's progress, not perfection.
And so what are your research areas then?
Well, to be honest, in the sort of the job that I do right now, I really don't have a lot of time for research.
Fair enough.
The vast majority of my time is taken up with, I still do some clinical duty at the school. During the academic year, I teach a lot. And then as the associate dean, I'm sort of in charge of overseeing the admissions process, overseeing the curriculum in years 1 through 3 of the program, and then dealing with the student services side of things. So we're hoping to publish some research on some of the things we've actually started developing, the teaching side of things. So if anything, that's probably where, you know, my sort of limited though it is research focus is actually more on understanding how we teach veterinary medicine, how people learn veterinary medicine.
Is there anything you found that's quite surprising in that area?
I think I'm actually just continually surprised, to be honest with you, about the complexity of best practices in teaching, actually how students learn, about how variable the way in which students learn are, and also the understanding that this might sound really self-evident, but the fact that when you're in university, you often look at it as an academic pursuit, right? So you go to classes, you learn the material, there's going to be an exam, and that's really your focus. But in a veterinary program, that's not the focus. Like, you have to learn stuff. There will be exams. There have to be exams because we need to make sure that students are progressing through the program. But that stuff's less important than, are you understanding this? Are you internalizing it and thinking about it, because you are going to be doing this, right? So I don't care very much if you can write an essay on how to do surgery. I need to know that you can do surgery. Right. I don't really care that you know the intricacies of a disease per se. You will need to know them, but it's, can you use that information to actually diagnose that disease in a real world scenario and develop a treatment plan for it? And so that's the bit that interests me more so. And you know, there is sort of a movement towards this in veterinary education, as there is in other forms of professional education, where we talk about competency-based education.
Right.
So that we're less assessing your knowledge and more assessing your competencies to do things when you're done in the program. And that's a real mindset. Like the students don't like that. Because the because they've all done some undergraduate years before they get into vet school. Right? They've all done at least 2 to 4 years of undergraduate training. So their mind is in this academic thing that grades matter. And, you know, I just need to get through this exam. And so I'm going to cram for this exam. But no, I don't care about cramming. Because if you learn it the night before the exam and then forget it the following evening, that's not going to help you be a veterinarian.
Mm-hmm.
So the students have been trained for an academic situation. So they don't like the fact that memorizing is not going to help them be an effective veterinarian. And to be honest, most of our faculty went through that, and this is new to them too. So trying to encourage our faculty to think slightly differently about the way they're teaching and their expectations for our students, because the way they did it is no longer necessarily the best way to do it. And so it's this interesting dynamic of trying to sort of educate faculty, staff, and students in best practice, and trying to, and also find the best way to do this, because like nobody really knows the best way right now. There's research being done in our school, in other vet schools, and we're looking and talking to one another and trying to understand the best practice for this. Because really what I'm asking the students to do is very different from what I was taught in vet school. Like people, you know, we didn't have these like real competency type of exams, and we didn't have opportunities to demonstrate that we were mastering the real intrinsic competencies of veterinary medicine rather than just demonstrating our knowledge.
Yeah, so you're on top of the students having this paradigm shift, you're also trying to figure out how to incorporate your paradigm, this paradigm, new paradigm, into your teaching as well.
And I mean, you know, it's great. I put into courses and I'm sort of thinking, okay, so I'm beginning to get my head around this. But then you've got a whole faculty in the college that needs to sort of come along behind this as well. And, you know, if you've been teaching the same material the same way for 30 years, you're not inclined to change it because you don't see a problem with it. You know, you're used to that system. And so being asked to change the way you teach is hard. Like, change is always hard for everybody.
Yeah, especially after decades of doing it that way. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's not that they were bad teachers. Like, some of them are excellent teachers and they've got a really good way of teaching. But it's just, is the outcome, essentially the outcome that we're now thinking we need.
Yeah, so it sounds like it's much more practical then once you get into the school.
We're trying to get there. I think our students would probably, in essence, still like to say they'd like more practical.
Okay.
But it's that balance, right? Because there really is a database of knowledge. Like, if it was like the Matrix and you could just download this information, life would be so much simpler. But what we ask our students to achieve in 4 years is almost impossible.
Yeah.
You know, they enter vet school. 4 years later, they graduate from vet school as a fully competent veterinarian who's fully licensed. And they have to be able to do medicine. They have to be able to do surgery. They have to be able to do anesthesia. They have to be able to do pathology. They have to be able to do diagnostic imaging. And basically, they have to be able to do that in at least 4 species.
Okay, that was my next question. Yeah, because there's not really any specificity, right?
When you there's a level of specialization that could come later, but we still get a general license. And so, I mean, that means dogs, cats, horses, cows are your sort of basic core. But our students are also going to learn swine, they're going to learn chickens, learn some sheep and goats, learn about some exotic species, learn a little bit of fish. Because we're the Western College of Veterinary Medicine. We are in Saskatoon, but we serve Western Canada. So we have a coastline, right? Which means there's a salmon industry that we have to serve.
Oh my goodness. That's a lot of space to be taken care of.
Well, yeah, I mean, we've reduced a little bit. So we used to be the vet school for Manitoba, Saskatchewan, Alberta, and British Columbia. Wow. Alberta's now built their vet school and dropped out of the funding agreement, but it's still Manitoba, Saskatchewan, British Columbia, and we also serve the territories.
Yeah.
You know, so our old dean used to say that we are the vet school for the western half of the second biggest country in the world.
That's incredible. And so are you serving a lot of private clients at the university from all those regions, or is it mostly research and commercial?
No, so we have a hospital at the vet school.
Like in the university?
In the university. Okay. And that hospital is broken up into three main areas. So we have a small animal clinic. So that does dogs and cats, and then all the other sort of exotic pets, so guinea pigs, rabbits, you know, you name it. Then we have a large animal clinic, which does mainly cows and horses, but also sheep, goats, llamas, you name it.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have what we call an ambulatory service, which is serving the same animals, but working out of the back of a truck on farms.
Oh, okay.
So we have those three clinics. The large animal clinic and the ambulatory service really sort of operates in an area about 120 kilometer radius around Saskatoon or thereabouts. The large animal clinic, it's people who will bring their animals to us.
Mm.
So mainly Saskatchewan, little bit of Manitoba and Alberta. And then the small animal clinic, we have some very specialized equipment, services, and clients here.
Mm-hmm.
So we do occasionally get people traveling much longer distances for some of the small animal things. So it's certainly really common to have people coming from Manitoba with dogs and cats to the clinic. Mm-hmm. And we do get some animals from British Columbia and that sort of thing because of the expertise that we have here.
Mm. Wow. And so does the distance kind of help it stay not super busy just because it's hard?
No, we are super busy.
Yeah.
Like we are, I mean, the small animal clinic is probably about as busy as it can possibly be. God. It would be very, very hard to increase the caseload without changes in staffing and pure physical space within the building. The large animal clinic has changed considerably since the school was founded just because of animal economics and everything. So they are less busy. And then the field service, it's very seasonal because, you know, farming follows a seasonal pattern.
Right.
So, but they're also pretty busy.
Wow.
So, no, we're busy. I think the small animal clinic sees... it's in the region of like 15,000, 16,000 patients a year.
Oh my gosh. Jeez. That's, yeah, I never would have thought about that. I actually didn't even know that the university had that hospital part to it. I thought it was just the students.
Well, stuff. We really have to because, I mean, the way our students are educated, they spend 3 years doing lectures and labs.
Mm.
And then their final year, they're doing clinical service alongside our clinical team.
Right.
So the students rotate through the different services in the hospital as part of a really hands-on experiential learning opportunity.
Wow.
And that's changed, actually, in terms of veterinary medicine. So historically, every vet school had to have a hospital where it trained its students. One of the things that's changed in the last... probably 15 years is this idea that there's a lot of vet schools been founded in the last 15 years and none of them have a hospital. And what they're doing is they're actually sending the students out into practices and using the practices for the students to get their hands on education. And that's what Calgary does. And it's a really interesting, you know, I think people's initial reaction, one must be good, one must be bad. No, there's pros and cons to both.
Yeah, they're just different.
They're
right?
just different.
Yeah. Do you know, I guess, if students favor one or the other?
Very complicated answer. Yeah. I mean, you know, one of the benefits is our students can have a base of operations here in Saskatoon. They have an apartment, whatever. They come to school. They can do all their education at the vet school, which is really great. If you're continually moving between practices, finding places to stay is incredibly problematic.
Yeah.
There's costs associated with it, but at the same time, our students are going to graduate and go out into those practices. So there's an element of benefit to learning the skills in that practice, but at the same time, we have faculty who have dedicated their lives to teaching and like having the students there. So there's a benefit to learning in a system that's like set up to teach rather than a really busy clinic where you might be shoehorned in on the side.
Yeah.
There are pros and cons, and so they're different, not better or worse.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. Yeah, especially when you're in a commercial environment too, because you're separating it. You're asking these private clinics to be teachers too, so it's a different job they're taking on as well. So,
yeah, and it takes more time if the student's going to be involved in the case, that sort of thing. And so the economics of the practice change. So some schools will actually pay the practices to take the students. It's different depending on where you are.
And so it sounded like at the beginning when we were talking, it sounds like you're more involved in the management of the college
And teaching are my two biggest things. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I still teach a lot.
Yeah.
And actually, that's the one thing, you know, it's actually very hard to oversee the college and teach at the same time. But like teaching is what gets me going. Yeah. And so there's just no way I'm going to give up teaching just to do the administration.
Mm. And so you're not involved in the hospital as much then? Or are you teaching
not as much, hospital? Not as much. But I mean, well, I mentioned to you earlier, like I have to get away right after this. Got to go see a case. Yeah, so no, I still see cases. I still participate in the the after hours call schedule and things like that. But I do a lot less clinical work than I used to.
Well, I can't imagine how busy you are then. I appreciate you taking the time to come and chat with me. So, and you're specialized in pharmacology, is that correct?
I sort of have two specializations in some respects. So, large animal internal medicine, mm-hmm. and then my PhD and some of my training there was in pharmacology, which mm-hmm. is, you know, the study of how drugs work. And so, being in internal medicine and pharmacology are actually incredibly complementary, because internal medicine is really about how you diagnose disease pick treatments. And then, obviously, most of those treatments involve drugs. So, the pharmacology is really a supplement to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a fascinating field, pharmacology. It's always so above my head, but I love learning about it and hearing about it just because it's like pharmacokinetics and the dynamics and just the fact that people like you can study this stuff and look at these things and understand not only that a drug treats a problem or a disease, but know where it goes in the body, what it does, how it's changing as it moves through the body and as it goes through different organs and it's metabolized and its metabolites and their interactions.
Yep.
That stuff, it blows my mind. I love hearing about it.
It's absolutely incredible. And then, of course, the other part, which is, you know, because you gave a great summary there. The other thing, no drug is 100% pure in its action. So you're always going to have other actions, whether it be the drug or the metabolites. And so, you know, one of the things that the students struggle with particularly is the understanding that every drug comes with risks, right? And so as a clinician, when you treat an animal, no matter how you're treating an animal, there are always risks associated with the treatment as well. And so what you're trying to do is basically a cost-benefit analysis, because there's always something that you can't control where the drug could cause a problem. And that problem could be as simple as an allergic reaction to the drug, which you really can't control. Like, until you've given the animal the drug, you don't know whether it's going to be allergic. You don't know whether this animal has something special about the way its liver is going to try and metabolize that drug. You don't know whether there's some other underlying health problem that's going to make the use of that drug slightly more risky in this patient. And so that becomes incredibly complex. And again, students have this slightly simplistic view of the world. They just want to know, animal has X disease, treat with Y. But the problem is you're never 100% certain of your diagnosis. And then you have options for treatment based off of a myriad of factors.
Right. Yeah.
And so this idea that every diagnosis is personalized to that case, and to some extent, every treatment is personalized to this case. It's not memorized. Mm-hmm. It's synthesized new for every case that you see.
Yeah, well, you really have to have a broad understanding of
things
that could go wrong. I imagine too that, like, even though that there's lots of medicines that work across species, there's probably an imaginable amount of very specific cases too, just because you're focusing on different species, right?
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, at least with the species I mainly deal with, they're all mammals, so there's an incredible amount of overlap, but there are key differences. Mm. So you're right, diseases differ by species. There are subtle differences in physiology, and there are subtle differences in the way that drugs will work. So some drugs work better in some species than others. Some drugs are actually much more dangerous in other species. And so that all has to be taken into account when you're practicing as a veterinarian. We have to find ways to educate that clearly to our students.
Yeah. Is there a specific animal or species that you liked working on the most or like working on the most?
I mean, I think, you know, in essence, I'm a cow doctor, right? That's where I've spent most of my career. And so I'm very comfortable working around cattle, whether that be beef cattle or dairy cattle, because the management systems are completely different and the diseases are different in the way we deal with them.
Right.
But they're very close to my heart. And then I actually paid my way through vet school working as a shepherd. So I actually, you know, sheep aren't just small cows, but they're a little different. But I really have a soft spot for sheep and goats.
Wow. Is that, how difficult was that? That feels like two, like more than full-time jobs you got going through vet school.
Well, actually, this is a thing that's slightly different about your education, because I grew up in the UK.
Right.
So we have three terms, not two semesters.
Okay.
And so we actually had a 5-week break over Easter. Mm. And so there's a real tradition of this in the UK. So I would like finish school on Friday afternoon and I would drive to a really big sheep farm. And then I would work like hell for 5 weeks because they were literally scheduled to start lambing the day after term finished.
Wow.
And so I would lamb out anywhere from, well, at one stage it was about 1,400 sheep. And then work there, like work like stink for 5 weeks and then turn around and come back to school. So that was well paid and it would like cover a bunch of my expenses for the year. Cool. So I wasn't like working all year round.
Yeah.
But that's the busiest time on a sheep farm. So
well, that makes sense. It's cool that it works out that way then.
Yeah. I mean, literally it's a system that's been in place for a long time there and a real tradition. So I went back year after. You had to do 3 weeks lambing. It was a requirement for our program. So I literally did 5 weeks every year all the way through my school to... Well, I enjoyed it and it was a great experience. And actually, the things I learned working on that farm are still things that I talk about in lectures with my students, right? Because it was that real life experience of real problems on a real farm with real economics and real issues and, you know, dealing with the fact that individual sheep don't have a huge amount of value. So how was veterinary care provided on those farms and that sort of thing?
That's really interesting. And so, sorry, you said lambing out. What is that?
Oh, sorry. It's just, so sheep are seasonal breeders. So sheep typically, well, their pregnancy is about 5 months long.
Okay.
Sheep only go, they only cycle. So they're only reproductively active at certain times of the year. So typically the fall. And so the farmers would literally arrange to put the rams in, knowing that they would then start lambing in sort of middle of March.
Right.
And so, yeah, I was there for the 5 weeks that the sheep, because again, sheep cycle on a 17-day cycle. And so typically you leave the rams in for two cycles, which is 34 days, which is 5 weeks. So typically a lambing season on a farm is 5 weeks long.
Wow. You said 1,400 you'd be...
Yeah.
Wow. And so when you're shepherding, like, what are you just moving them to different areas or like...
Depends a lot on the operation. The way we were set up, we... You can mark your sheep so that you know which ones are going to lamb early and which ones are going to lamb later. And this operation had a very large barn, so we would bring in the sheep that were close to lambing into a barn, and they would be in the barn there. And so my job was feeding them, ensuring they had bedded, had access to water, and then watching out for when they started lambing, assisting if they had any problems lambing. And then very importantly with sheep, because it's a behavior thing, you need to get the mother penned up in a small pen with the lambs for about 24 hours to allow the maternal bond to develop.
Oh, okay.
Because once a sheep is associated with her lambs, she will look for them, she'll care for them. But when they're in the process of giving birth, it's really easy to get a lot of mismothering and issues. So that was a big part of the job. Yeah, and then routine processing, looking for common diseases, treating those diseases, trying to keep the lambs as healthy as possible, and then getting them out to pasture, and then checking the pastures, looking for health problems, dealing with those. So, you know, just all aspects of their care. This, as I said, when people in the general public sort of have this feeling that animals aren't cared for or respected. I mean, you know, I was working 16, 18 hours a day.
Yeah,
right. You know, my number one focus was ensuring that these animals are healthy and that they have the best possible welfare.
Yeah.
So they have to be in a barn because it's raining in the UK, and if they get wet, they get cold and they'll die of hypothermia.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to pen them up in these small pens because we have to let that maternal bond develop.
Mm-hmm.
So everything we do, there's a purpose for, and hopefully you could get into a dialogue with people to explain why it's done this way and what the benefits of it are.
Yeah, totally. Chris, I'm very sorry. I think I meant to put this cat away and she's going to
keep worrying. No, don't worry. I'm a veterinarian. Having a cat at the door is completely normal. Don't worry.
Yeah, I'll put her away. I'll be real quick.
I honestly, she doesn't bother me, but if it's going to bother your recording.
I think, yeah.
Okay.
Or meowing show up, so. No. Come on. I'll be right back.
Okay, no problem.
Sorry about that.
No problem at all.
I think I lost my train of thought as well. Got distracted by the cat. We were just talking about
sheep.
Working
as a shepherd.
My next question was, when you're out, like when you're taking them out to pasture and stuff, the sheep, do you have herd dogs with you or?
So in the UK, I was mainly working with, my boss had border collies as herding dogs. So when you're moving sheep over distances and moving them between fields, you know, we would use border collies to help gather the sheep together and then drive them in a controlled way between fields and that sort of thing. Since I came to Western Canada, I'm much more now used to, obviously, the herding dogs are still a thing, but the fact of guardian dogs have really been redeveloped and reestablished here. So as well as the herding dogs, the typical border collie, you've got guardian breeds like the Great Pyrenees or the Maremma, which are these big white dogs that live with the flock. And their job is to actually protect the flock from predators. So, you know, in Western Canada, the coyote is a real problem with sheep because lambs especially, it's easy for a coyote to try and hunt those and kill them. And so you have to learn how to manage your flock with respect to predation and having the right guardian breeds, which is a really old-fashioned concept. I mean, it's what these breeds were originally developed for. Having these dogs in with the flock, bonded to the flock and actually protecting the flock from predators is a whole sort of other thing that I've had to learn about since I've been in Western Canada, because the fox really isn't that much of a predator in the UK for sheep, but the coyote is.
Does the fox cause much problems at all for
I mean, they'll take the odd lamb occasionally, and there's certainly a problem with poultry, like free-range poultry and that sort of thing.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense.
But, you know, the fox is just so much smaller, it really can't take on a sheep in the same way that a coyote can. And then when actually being in Western Canada, when they were using sheep in the clear cuts in the Rockies and things like that, well, then you start having to deal with bears as predators and things like this as well. So, you know, the sheep just being that much smaller, they do need that protection from predators.
Wow. Yeah, the I went to a in grade 8 I went to an alpaca farm. And I can't remember what it was in Saskatchewan, but and they didn't have guardian animals, or at least not that they showed us, and we didn't learn much about the predation. But watching the shepherd command the border collies was one of the coolest things I'd ever seen in my life. I had no idea that you could have that specific of commands with animals and just control a herd like that.
It's absolutely unbelievable to watch when it's well done. And I mean, it's funny again, because I grew up in a different country. Growing up in the UK, they actually had televised sheepdog trials. It wasn't like the most popular show in the world, but I have vivid memories of watching this show, and literally it's incredible what a shepherd can do with a whistle or like just whistling on their fingers and making these dogs move sheep through obstacles, round obstacles. It's witchcraft. Because if you've never tried to move sheep yourself, you don't realize how hard it is. Like, they're a prey animal and they're scared and they want to scatter. And so having them move as a group is incredibly hard to do. And so the skill required of the shepherd and the dog is just unfathomable. It's incredible.
It literally makes no sense when you're watching it, because you're thinking about that, like, not only is the shepherd's trying to figure out what the best placement is for the animals, but then also the has to be giving commands to multiple dogs at the same time.
They can be, and the dogs know what they need to do, right? So, I mean, what you're really doing is using. In fact, what it is that wolves hunt as a group,
right?
And so they drive the sheep in order to hunt, and so you're actually using the inbred hunting instinct of the dog, but taking away that piece from it, and so. You're giving the dogs, I can best describe it as advice. Telling them exactly what to do. Like, the dogs have got a sense of what they need to do anyway.
That's so incredible. Wow. And so were you ever commanding the dogs? I'm not sure if that's the right word, but
no, it is the right word. So the dogs I worked with weren't the best. And so mainly you were telling them to stop and lie down because they were pushing too hard.
Okay.
And so I was never at that level. I mean, you were basically at the fact that I had sheep in a big field. I needed to get them to another field. And so at some point, the dog would work out. The gate was open and I needed the sheep to go into the other field. Yeah. And then the dog would just do it.
Okay.
Like yeah. My ability to actually control movement beyond that was minimal. So once the dog worked out what I was trying to do, it was best to just let the dog get on with it. So yeah, I was never at that level of control. That's ever.
Funny. Wow. And in the videos I've seen too of the dogs, dogs doing it, it always looks like they're just having a blast.
Oh yeah. Yeah. No, yeah. They really, really are. Like yeah. Border collies are just born to run. I mean, yeah. People watch this and they just think, oh, I'd be such a wonderful pet. They do not make great pets.
Yeah.
Like, they need to run, and they're so smart and so intelligent. If you lock them up in a house all day, they just don't know what to do with themselves.
Yeah,
they can become quite neurotic. Yeah. But they make great dogs for, like, obedience or agility, potentially, things like that. But people used to buy border collie puppies up in the area where I used to work as a veterinarian in the UK, and you'd hear stories about this dog would escape its house, and it would go to like the schoolyard and it would just start hurting children. Right? That's just awesome. Because that's what it was born to do. Yeah. And if it didn't have that outlet, it kind of just lost its mind.
Yeah, it just knows. I can't remember what the other breed I heard was, but yeah, there's another breed of dog that I heard is really bad for that. And I think this breed was typically used for like shows. It was a show dog. I can't remember what kind it was, but I guess it was the same thing. Like if you didn't have them outside exercising all the time, they would just tear your house up.
There's several breeds like that. Yeah. You know, these breeds are just designed to just go all day and be stimulated.
Yeah.
There are some breeds that just would curl up on a sofa and just, they're good, right? They just want to be around people and they make great pets. There's other ones, you know, everyone's going to be individual. The one that always surprises me actually is greyhounds. Because you know greyhounds as being this racing dog and everything else, and they can run incredibly fast, and you know they're obviously trained for that. But if you put them in a house, they just become couch potatoes. They're like they're really funny. They just curl up on a chair and they'll stay there pretty much all day.
That is interesting. I didn't know that. Yeah,
but
well, yeah, they're so fascinating. Some dogs. It's interesting too when you get like into the different breeds and looking at like how like breeds have really common characteristics between them, and of course like they're all the same breed, but it's always fascinating to me because we don't typically think of humans as being that way, and I think maybe because we're not bred specifically for traits all the time. But like my girlfriend's sister has a Jack Russell, and that thing will lose its mind if it's not moving. Has to be going constantly. But then you look at another dog, like you said, some of them are just couch potatoes.
It is. It's interesting to some extent. So you know, you're right. So they're all the same species, but the impact that humans have had on them by selective breeding. I mean, we see this in other species as well. Obviously, we've selected for different strains of cattle and horses and whatever else. But I think dogs, it's where it's most notable of what the impact that selective breeding can have on a species, and it's truly unimaginable actually how much as humans we've been able to manipulate biology through selective breeding in some of the domestic species. But dogs, certainly when you think about the Chihuahua versus the Great Dane, right, they're the same species, and we've selectively bred a dog that's, you know, this big to a dog that, you know, is 4 feet high.
Yeah, it's crazy. Is it true that dogs that are like more purebred tend to have more issues, like joint wise and like in physical health?
I think there's an element of truth there. I mean, I'm not a small animal practitioner, but the reality is when you're doing selective breeding and you're selecting for specific traits, and you're typically potentially breeding close relatives, you're going to start to develop a greater propensity for genetic problems.
Right.
So in a lot of purebred dogs, there are some issues that we've come to identify, whether that be propensity for certain types of cancer, skin disease, you mentioned joint disease, We know there's some eye problems and so on, and we see some muscle problems as well. So there's a wide variety of genetic problems start to show up just because the genetic pool that breed was developed from was somewhat limited.
Mm.
Whereas when you get a sort of typical mutt that's been repeatedly crossbred, the recessive genetic problems are typically masked. So it's really the recessive ones that become more prevalent when you start selective breeding.
Yeah. So you mentioned that cows are your kind of area. Does similar stuff happen in cows as well with selective breeding causing issues or issues?
No, I mean, anytime, I guess it's the law of unintended consequences or whatever else. But there are genetic disorders in most breeds of cattle.
Mm.
Whether there's, I'm just trying to think of some simple ones. I mean, most people wouldn't know these things, but there's in dairy cows, for example, there's a thing where their eyes twitch,
which we
know to be a genetic problem. Some dairy cattle have problems with bleeding disorders like hemophilia.
Yeah.
Then there's some genetic problems in genetic neurological problems in most breeds of cattle. Like most of these are disappearing now because we know how to test for them and avoid them and things like that. But there are specific genetic disorders that are associated with most breeds of cattle. They're extremely rare, but depending on how narrow the genetic pool was, they can become quite problematic and cause problems. I mean, I don't want to get into the pros and cons of this, but like certainly at one stage it was very common to dehorn cattle, and so when we use local anesthetic and whatever else, but when you cut the horns off, this could be bleeding. Most male cattle are castrated, so if you've got cattle that have a clotting disorder, that becomes a huge problem.
Yeah.
And so these were actually identified, and now they've been almost selectively bred out of the certain breeds, but those were huge problems because if you're going to do something to a cow that can result in some bleeding and its blood doesn't clot properly, you're going to find out about it pretty quickly.
And unfortunately too. Is it common for farms to have lots of different breeds of cows, or is it typically one? Or
depends a little bit on the farm, actually. So for example, dairy cows, the most common dairy cow you're going to see is the Holstein, which is the big black and white cow.
Right.
They've been selectively bred as a really prolific milker.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the most common dairy breed you're going to see. You might see some others, but that's pretty common. On the beef side of things, there's a number of specific breeds. And so when you look at a beef farm, it's probably simplest to divide the beef farms into two types. And so the first would be the purebred breeders. And so they typically will have just one breed. And they're breeding the next generation of really high quality bulls and the next generation of really high quality cows. And so they're selling mainly replacement stock to other farmers who need a bull or whatever else. And then the other type of beef farm is what I would call a commercial farm. And so that's one where they have cows that are having calves, and those calves are typically going to go into the meat trade. And so they will buy a really good bull because that's 50% of your genetics.
Right.
But the cows may be quite a mixed bag.
Oh, okay.
Right. Yeah. So, that's how those things operate. So again, depending on the farm, you may see just one breed.
Mm-hmm.
You might see multiple breeds.
Oh. That makes sense. Yeah, I guess everybody's got different needs and different wants, right?
Yeah.
On your page on the USAS website, like on your biography, you put that you're, I can't remember what the first one was. Your two great interests are education and cow's feet.
Yeah.
What was the feet part of it?
So it actually started when I was a student, and it's not something you think about. So when people think about horses, they probably think about blacksmiths and farriers. Like everybody knows that like horses have been, they need their feet trimmed and they typically been shod depending on, so people have to make their own horseshoes and so on. So cows, it's interesting because cows have two toes rather than one, but there's a hoof on both toes. And it grows all the time. And then depending on how you manage them, there are going to be problems with their feet, just like there are in horses. And most of the time it's largely ignored, but you know, it's a huge problem, particularly in the dairy industry. Like, these animals need their feet to be taken care of.
Right, yeah.
And it's not particularly glamorous. It's hard work. The cows really don't want to cooperate. It's not like horses. They're not going to stand there and let you trim their feet. So you've got to come up with ways of restraining them and lifting their feet.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I was a student, it became apparent to me working with veterinarians like how much of their time was spent dealing with lame cows. And so I developed real interest in it. And I was like one of these things like, if I know this is what's going to happen to cows all the time, I want to know how to treat them.
Right.
And so I did some extra training. I went and got certified as a foot trimmer while I was still a vet student. And then when I came to the vet school here in Saskatoon, there's always been a long history of dealing with lame cattle here. We have some amazing facilities.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just something I've always wanted to do. A lot of people don't want to do it because, as I said, it's awkward, it's dirty, it's hard work. You know, most of our trimming is still done with hand tools, knives, and nippers. And so, you know, there's a real knack to it. And I watch the students, I teach labs where I try to teach the students how to do this. And I watch them become so frustrated because they're trying to do something they've never done before. And they get incredibly frustrated because you give me a hoof knife and ask me to trim a foot, two slices and I'm done.
Yeah.
But I've trimmed thousands of feet and they hold a knife and it won't cut into the hoof. It bounces off. They tell me the knife's blunt. I show them I can trim with it. They can't. And I just give them the advice I was given by my mentor, which is, don't worry, the first 1,000 are the hardest.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, once you've done 1,000, you'll get the hang of it. Yeah. But people don't want to go through that novice phase.
No, of course not.
And, you know, and as I said, it's hard work, but it's super common. And it's incredibly important for their welfare.
Mm-hmm.
Because the reason animals are lame is because their feet hurt.
Right.
And pain is unacceptable from a welfare perspective. So, you know, as a veterinarian who's committed to improving the welfare of the animals that I'm responsible for, being able to alleviate that pain, being able to prevent that pain is a really important part of my job.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's not glamorous, but it's really important.
Yeah.
And so I've just learned to enjoy it.
And so when you refer to lame, what exactly do you mean?
So lameness means that the animal's gait, the way that it's walking, is uneven. And so typically that is because there is pain associated with them bearing weight on that limb.
Hmm.
And playing the odds game, like 90% of the time, if an animal is showing lameness, it's going to have a problem in its foot.
Right.
They can get problems higher up the leg, but it's actually extremely rare.
Hmm.
So most of the time they have got an abscess in their foot, they've got a stone stuck in their foot, they've developed a severe bruise, they've got some other degenerative conditions, there may be an infection. And so what you've got to do is get the foot up, you've got to look at it, you've got to palpate it, you've got to feel for heat, you've got to look at the skin. Sounds really gross, but sometimes you've got to smell it because certain infections have characteristic odors. And then once you've worked out what the problem is, then you develop a treatment plan for it. And one of the things I love about dealing with cattle feet actually is it's incredibly rewarding because most of the time I can get the foot up, look at it, identify the problem, and pretty much solve it in one go. It's not like it's going to be sometimes there's long-term treatment options and various things like that, but 90% of the time, you know, it takes me 20 minutes and I've solved the problem. And that's incredibly gratifying because a lot of things are long-term, right?
Yeah.
You get to solve it at once. It takes time. You have to persuade the farmer to change their management, things like that. Whereas if it's an abscess, I drain the abscess.
And they're good.
Problem solved.
Yeah. Well, then the cow looks so much happier and is walking straight. Yeah, well.
Yeah.
And so, like, back to the hoofs specifically, do they just keep growing then if they're not like roughing them out on?
So biologically, it's really hard to get your head around this.
Okay,
but horses and cows have the same biology as our limbs.
Okay, yeah.
Right. So when you look at a cow's leg, all the same biological structures are there. So when a cow is standing, it's actually standing on two fingers or two toes.
Two fingers, okay, yeah.
Right? So they have a wrist, they have an ankle, they have the same bones. And so the hoof is just a fingernail that has wrapped itself around the end of the digit.
Okay.
And so in the same way that your fingernails grow every day, their hooves will grow every day. Now, if they're on the right type of ground and they're moving the right way, that growth rate should be exactly the same as the wear rate from the ground that they're standing on. But ground gets wet, some ground is more abrasive than others, and so on. And so beef cattle typically don't need a ton of care, but they will still need some. Bulls especially need care. Dairy cows are different. Dairy cows don't walk as far. And so typically they do need routine hoof care in a way that the beef cattle typically don't.
That makes sense.
But yeah, so you're absolutely right. It grows. It's like a fingernail. If you don't trim it, it'll get long. When it gets long, it's at risk of breaking, snagging, getting things stuck under it. And all the same things.
When you say walking on two toes, like, because like a human foot, you have the digits and then the foot is on the ground. So is it that part in their structures, it's actually, it's not touching the ground at all.
They're literally standing on their tiptoes.
Oh my goodness. Yeah.
Right? That's what people don't understand. A horse is literally standing on one toe.
That's so strange. Yeah. And so does it cause, I think you might have said this already, but do they, in cows and horses then, do they have issues typically with their, I guess their ankles or in their...
Well, I mean, so it's one of these things like biology, evolution has developed this system. So yes, it can have problems, but it's actually very well designed for what they do. Mm-hmm. So they have really powerful ligaments. They have specific muscles that hold everything together. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, they can have problems. I mean, cattle tend not to get a lot of problems in the upper limb because they just wander around the field.
Yeah.
But when you make a horse start running really fast with someone on its back and jumping over things and cornering abruptly, they do start to get problems in the upper limb. So they get sprains, they get strains, they get bone damage, they get joint damage. Mm. And so that's a whole level of another type of sort of veterinary practice.
Yeah.
Of dealing with sport horses and dealing with those injuries. And, you know, as I said, in cows, it's easy because in cows, the lameness is almost always the foot.
Mm-hmm.
And that's common in horses too. But once you've worked out it's not the foot, then one of the skills of a veterinarian is trying to work out where that lameness is in the leg. Because, you know, the horse can't talk. He can't point and say it hurts here.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a whole bunch of different techniques we have to use to try to isolate where the pain is in the leg.
Yeah.
Because once you know where the pain is, then you can start to go looking with x-rays or ultrasound to see exactly what the problem is. But I mean, a horse's leg is long, right? So you start off with a horse that's not walking, right? You have to work out which leg it's lame in first.
Mm.
So you have to watch it walk, and there's a real knack to saying, okay, so I think it's the front right leg that's the problem. And then I have to work out where in the leg the problem is, and then I can go to x-ray. Mm-hmm. People often think, oh, you know, just a vet, just x-ray to find out what the problem is. Well, x-rays only show up bones. If the problem's in the muscle, it's not going to show up. So I have to work out where in the leg. So I have to be able to flex joints, feel joints, do things where we like flex the joint really hard and then make the horse walk to see if that makes the lameness worse.
Mm-hmm.
And then we start putting local anesthetic in and actually blocking the individual nerves in the leg to see if we can work out, oh, I blocked the nerve right there and the pain disappeared. So now I know that the problem's here.
That's really interesting. Wow. Yeah, I guess, it's probably easy for people on the outside to say, well, like, just keep taking scans of it. But
every x-ray costs money.
Yeah.
It takes time. And every x-ray involves putting radiation into the horse, which we don't want, and exposes the veterinarian and their staff to low levels of radiation, right? So we want to, you know, it comes back to the thing we were talking about right at the beginning about, like, that decision of what test am I going to use? How much is it going to cost than everything else? So, you know, I want to take the minimum number of x-rays that I need to take to confirm the diagnosis.
Right.
I don't want to just start at the bottom and start x-raying my way up the leg, because that's going to become incredibly expensive and it's exposing everybody to unnecessary levels of radiation.
Yeah. No, definitely don't want to keep doing that. And we've got 4 more minutes here.
Oh my goodness. The time went.
Yeah, it flies by. Is there anything we didn't cover that you wanted to? Or I know we didn't talk about education as much. But
no, I don't know, really. I would encourage people to actually have an open mind and ask questions, right? So I often find people are, scared to ask questions. I find this in students as well. So like, if you don't know or you don't understand, ask a question. Like, ask a veterinarian why they're doing that. Ask a farmer why they're doing it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're doing it for a reason, right? And sometimes the answer will challenge you, right? And you may need to ask additional questions to understand why. Like, why do you do that? You know, how did we come to the decision that this is the right way to keep animals? How did we come to the decision that this is the right way to treat animals for disease? And oftentimes there's really strong evidence behind those things. I mean, we didn't talk about it at all, but actually the idea of evidence-based medicine, that we don't do these things just because we think they're right, that there's research to back it up, and that this is the best answer we have right now. But again, 10 years time, we could change.
Yeah.
Like, the history of medicine is the history of change. I mean, we used to believe in the four humors. We used to believe that you could treat everything by bleeding animals and humans, by extracting blood from them would treat everything. Yeah. We now realize that there's literally about one condition where bleeding is the appropriate treatment. Yeah. You know, that was, but we did it for thousands of years. You know, and so we're always improving. Again, progress, not perfection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's, I think, perfectly said. And if people want to find your work and or get in contact with you or the college, where can they go?
Yeah, so just the Vet College website is WCVM, Western College of Veterinary Medicine, .ca, so you can, or .com, sorry. You can go there and look at things. The other thing I would actually suggest is, every 2 years, we have an open house in September at the vet school run by our students. They do an incredible job. So it's not this year. It'll be next year in 2024, okay. Typically the end of September. The whole vet schools open up. The students make it an incredible educational opportunity. Any questions you have about veterinary medicine, about the way that we keep animals, opportunity to see a lot of different animals. I think a lot of people who grew up in Saskatoon probably remember going to VetaVision. Mm. So watch out for VetaVision. It's a great opportunity to learn about this.
Awesome. Cool. Well, thank you so much. I had a great time and I learned a lot.
Great. It was a really great challenge to you.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for being here.
Bye.